Okay, let's get going. So I think at least most of the class seems to be back. Okay, so we're going to finish off our discussion of null hypersurfaces. And let's just go back a couple of little things that we've talked about and I'm going to be using in the next part of the discussion. So here I'm focusing on one of those hypersurfaces that we've talked about. So each one is described by a quantity u being equal to a constant, and then we get for free the congruence of null generators on the hypersurface. We have lambda as a running parameter on the geodesics. We have theta a, where a is either 2 or 3, as constant generator labels, so they stay constant as we move up the generators. We have k as being tangent to the generators, and EA that goes from generator to another generator. So that's a separation vector between two generators, and both K and A and E are tangent to the hypersurface. We've defined them in this way in terms of partial derivatives. We're taking the embedding relations to be relationships between the spacetime coordinates and the intrinsic coordinates that we're using on the horizon, and the tangent vectors are going to be given by those partial derivatives, and then we get the null vector if we differentiate with respect to lambda, and the spatial vectors, transverse vectors, if we differentiate with respect to theta a. And we've talked about the fact that the induced metric on the hypersurface is two-dimensional, and it's a metric that lives in a purely transverse space, a notion that we've talked about for quite some time. And then I came up with this description of the metric if we're using u, lambda, and theta a as a system of space-time coordinates, then we can write down a metric that basically reflects the null structure that those coordinates give us. Excuse me. Okay, so now what I want to do for the next little while is to ask what happens to those basic vectors as we move them up along the null generators on one of those hypersurfaces. So I want to derive transport equations for those vectors, and I want to extract some consequences of all of this. And we're going to see that there's something interesting that comes out of this, and something that we've encountered in a different way before. So before I get into it, just a slight reminder. So here we have vectors that are defined in terms of partial derivatives. And because they're defined in terms of partial derivatives, we have this commuting property on their second derivatives that gives us a Lie identity between those vectors. So what I'm trying to say here is that the E vectors are Lie transported against a vector K. Excuse me. I'm having trouble with my throat. And that translates into this equation right here that tells us that the k derivative of E is the same thing as the E derivative of k. And that's something that we've encountered before quite a few times, and I'm going to be using it in the next little while. Okay. So let me just write down what I meant by those transport equations. And what I mean by that is basically an evolution equation for the basis vectors. So the first one we've already encountered, that's the geodesic equation, and that tells us how k varies as we move up the congruence. So it's the derivative of k in the direction of k being equal to k apart from that factor of kappa. So that's an equation that I would call a transport equation. And then I might want to write another one like this for the tangent vectors. And on the face of it, I don't know what that is, and I certainly don't expect those vectors to be satisfying the geodesic equation. So what I should contemplate here is to write this right-hand side here as a general decomposition of a vector in terms of all the basis vectors that we were given. And in principle, there would be, a component along n, but that turns out to be zero, so I'll omit that, and I'll show you why in a second. But there will be a component along k, and there will be a component along the e vectors. So I'll write it like that. And those quantities, kappa, omega A, and BAB, well, are things that I can calculate based on the metric that we gave ourselves. If I were to just, take the metric, calculate Christoffel symbols, and see what those things are in terms of those quantities. So I won't do all of those calculations because they're pretty straightforward and, not terribly interesting. But I'll give you the answer about this in a moment. But for the time being, I just want to convince you that while this is what the right-hand side, should be, and the only thing noticeable about this is that while the eventual component of the vector on the right-hand side along n vanishes. So the thing to notice is that there's no component along n. And to show this, all we have to do is to take a scalar product with k. Because if we take that scalar product with k alpha, well, of course, this will vanish. This will vanish because k is orthogonal to k. K is orthogonal to the e vectors. But if we had a component like this, k with n is minus one. So if we calculate k alpha, in principle, we would be revealing that component along n. And I want to show that this scalar product is in fact zero, and that will prove the point. So we want to calculate this. And let's see. So there's probably lots of ways of doing this, but I'll just do it the most straightforward way. I will rely on that Lie identity that I just wrote down and express it like this. And then it's pretty much game over because I recognize this as one half E beta A gradient of K alpha, and that's zero, and therefore all of that is zero. So that's the proof that we don't have a component along n, so that the most general conceivable transport equation you can get for the e vectors is given by that. This quantity here is not going to be terribly interesting for us, but that one, and I've chosen the notation in a sort of suggestive way, that one is going to be very interesting for us. And I'm going to be focusing on that in just for the next little while. Before I do that, I could tell you what these things are if we were to do that calculation that I described before, namely take the metric that we talked about and calculate the Christoffel symbols and then use those Christoffel symbols in the evaluation of those covariant derivatives. If we were to do this calculation, we would find that kappa is equal to the lambda derivative of chi. And that should not be a surprising result because we've defined it before as the derivative of chi in the direction of k, and that's exactly what this is. So we're reproducing that through those Christoffel symbols. Omega A, well, that's a bit more complicated. That, after that calculation involving Christoffel symbols, would be given by the theta A derivative of chi minus e to the minus chi omega AB, the lambda derivative of WB. So that's the quantity that appeared in the metric as we wrote it down before. So that's not terribly interesting for us, but the thing that is interesting is that BAB is in fact one half the lambda derivative of the transverse metric. And that seems to be an important quantity because while that tells us everything about the geometry of the transverse space, and what we're finding here is that BAB is, apart from that one half, is the rate of change of that transverse metric as we move up the congruence. And because we might be interested in the geometry of those transverse spaces, and of course we are, how that geometry changes in time is something that's, very important for us to work out, and that's what's captured here by this BAB quantity.
So shall we conclude that it is proportional to the extrinsic curvature?
Right. So here we would have an interesting sort of different notion of extrinsic curvature, because it would be a two-dimensional extrinsic curvature for the transverse spaces embedded in the null hypersurface. So it's not quite the same notion of extrinsic curvature as we've talked about, but it's analogous, but it's two-dimensional as opposed to three-dimensional, and it's two-dimensional as embedded in a null three-dimensional space. So, but yeah, I mean, it certainly has that flavor, including the factor of 1/2. So very nice thing for you to notice.
Thank you.
Okay, let's look into that quantity a little bit more, because it is pretty important. What I want to prove is that BAB can also be expressed as follows. It's the projection in the transverse space of the gradient of the K vector. And if you remember, from a couple of weeks ago, we talked a lot about taking the gradient of a null vector and decomposing it into the NKE, well, in a, so we were decomposing it into a basis involving the K and N vector, but we were not doing anything explicit with the transverse spaces. Now we have those vectors that are pointing in the transverse space. And in that discussion that we came up, that we did before, we were very interested in, finding that the most interesting aspect of this gradient was happening purely in the transverse directions. So that's the kind of thing that I was calling, B double projected alpha beta. Well, now the projection is being handled by those vectors, and what survives is the purely transverse part of the gradient. So this is the purely transverse part of the gradient. And as we argued before, that's also the most interesting part of this. And BAB is, what captures that fully and completely, and made more explicit by the fact that now we have a basis that that lives in that transverse space of of the congruence, and it's also the transverse space of the null hypersurface. So let me prove this, because that's not something that I've that's something that I just wrote down, but I need to prove that for you. So let's do that. I'm going to use the Lie identity again. So I'm starting here with this. Well, let's start with the right-hand side. And what I'm going to do is to write it like this, where I'm going to emphasize that we're taking the gradient of the K vector in the direction of E. And according to the Lie identity, that's the same thing as the gradient in the direction of K of the E vector. And the only difference is that, well, I keep the index down here. So what do we have? Well, we have right? So we have that. So we have the projected gradient here, but that's something for which I have, a transport equation. So I've already wrote down what this looks like in the basis that's given. And I can just plug that result into here. And what I'm going to get here, just adapting the index a little bit, so omega a k beta plus b, let's call it BAC, EC beta. So that's according to my transport equation, that's what this gives me. And now I can take that projection in the direction of EB. And of course, this scalar product between K and E vanishes, so we don't get anything here. And other than that, what do we get? Well, we get BAC, and we get the scalar product between a B vector and a C vector. And that's precisely what we call our transverse metric. And then the only remaining step here, according to the convention that we gave ourselves, is to use the metric to lower this index. And sure enough, we end up with BAB. So that's pretty good. So that brings a very interesting link between the rate of change of the transverse metric and the transverse part of the gradient of the null vector. So we made a big deal about this in the past, and now we see the connection explicitly between that and the rate of change of the transverse geometry as we go up the congruence. So again, a very interesting correspondence between old stuff that we've talked about and a new connection now that we're talking about the properties of the hypersurface, not just the property of the congruence. All right, so that's something. And the other thing that we did in the past was to decompose that into smaller pieces. So we can do a similar decomposition that we did before. Namely, we can take this symmetric tensor. Now it's a two-dimensional tensor. It's symmetric, obviously, as we can see it here. It has to be symmetric if the metric is symmetric. We can also establish symmetry directly from the from this relationship, do a very similar calculation. But what we can do is to decompose this symmetric matrix into a trace piece and a trace-free piece. So the trace piece is something that now will be defined relative to the transverse metric. And of course, we're going to call the coefficient here theta, and that's going to be our rate of expansion. And then a symmetric trace-free piece that we're going to call sigma, and that's going to be our shear tensor. So that's going to be the rate of expansion. Same quantity that we derived, that we talked about before. It's defined in exactly the same way, except that we're doing it in a more explicit way because now we have, we have the transverse vectors at our disposal. So that's going to be the same theta that we've talked about in the past in the case of a null congruence. And together with that, we have the rate of shear. And the condition here in the decomposition is that with theta is going to be the trace of BAB, and sigma is going to be defined to have zero trace. So so sigma is going to be the full thing minus the trace part. So familiar things that we've encountered before, but now it's encountered in a slightly different way. But it still means exactly the same thing, because regardless, we are talking about the transverse piece of the vector gradient. And that's exactly what, what we were dealing with when we were doing this with congruences instead of hypersurfaces. Okay. We had a discussion about the rate of expansion before, and we know that it corresponds to, it corresponds to the fractional rate of change of two-dimensional areas. So let's reproduce all of this, but now based on this, sort of more explicit language that we've been developing. So let's talk about the evolution of cross sections. So here's my hypersurface. And what I'm going to do is to define a region. I'm going to define a cross section. Well, let me do this first. I'm going to define a domain of my theta coordinates by selecting the null geodesics that are enclosed in that domain. So what I'm saying here is that, well, I'm going to, delineate this domain by a certain, spread in theta a coordinates. And I'm going to follow this domain forward in time along the geodesics. And I know that the domain will stay the same in time because my geodesics move with a fixed value of theta. So we have a domain D of the hypersurface defined by, a spread delta theta A in the generator labels. And a property of this is that as I follow those geodesics in time, the domain D doesn't change with lambda. So that's something that we'll use in what follows. So take a bundle of geodesics and follow them up in time, and that defines a domain of the theta angles. And I'm going to define a cross section to be a surface of constant lambda in that domain. So that's going to be lambda equal constant. That's going to be another lambda equal constant surface. And here it looks like a line, but of course I've suppressed the dimension. So this is really a two-dimensional surface. And that's what I'm going to be calling, that's going to, how I'm going to be defining the cross section. So a cross section of the domain D is, I don't want to express it like this. I'm just going to say that a cross section of the bundle of null geodesics is going to be a 2D first, is going to be defined to be a 2D surface of constant lambda. And what I would like to calculate based on the information that that we have so far is the rate of change of the area of that cross section. So what we would like to calculate is the rate of change of the cross-sectional area. So what do I mean by that? Well, by cross-sectional area, what I will mean, of course, I'll call it A, that's going to be the integral in the domain D. I could do it over the entire null surface, but I'm going to do it over just any domain D like this as defined. And it's going to be the integral of the surface element on that domain. And more explicitly, of course, that's going to be square root of omega d2 theta. And that will be the, area defined in the induced metric omega ab of that bundle of geodesics that defines that domain D. So that's what I mean by cross-sectional area. And what I want to calculate here is the rate of change of that surface area over time. All right, so that's the goal. And we're going to calculate this. And the calculation, well, in principle, might involve the rate of change, or would have to account for the fact that the domain, in principle, could have depended on time. And that's why I took a minute to specify that here we're dealing with a domain that doesn't specify on time, which means that when I take the lambda derivative to the integral, I'm going to be able to pass it inside the integral, and it's going to translate into a partial derivative of omega with a square root. So if we do the calculation, well, we're really calculating how the integral changes with time, or changes with the parameter lambda. And if the domain D depended on time, we would have to account for this. But now we're told that D doesn't change with time. So we can just take the derivative inside the integral, and now it becomes a partial derivative with respect to lambda that's acting on that square root of the metric determinant. And that's true because D is lambda independent, as we talked about. Okay. So now we need this. We need to calculate this. And the way to do this is to just understand how a determinant of a matrix changes if we start changing all of its, the element of that matrix. So if we have a matrix M and, it has a whole bunch of entries, now we could differentiate the matrix with respect to some kind of parameter that would induce a change in the matrix. And then the idea would be, how does that reflect itself in the change in the determinant? So I change all the entries here by differentiating with some kind of parameter, and that changes the matrix, and that change is going to be reflected in its determinant. And we need a rule that will allow us to calculate the change in determinant or the derivative of the determinant in terms of the matrix itself. And I won't derive what that is. That's a result of linear algebra. I'll just state what the rule is. I'll just say that the lambda derivative of the determinant of some matrix M, assuming that the elements of the matrix depend on a parameter lambda, that's equal to the determinant that multiplies the trace of the matrix inverse times the derivative of the matrix. And you can't see this because it's hidden from view. So that's the rule. So if we know how the matrix is changing, we can figure out by this calculation how the determinant is changing. So if we translate into the 2x2 matrix that we're talking about here, namely omega, then on the right-hand side, we're going to have the determinant again, namely omega. And then we're going to have the trace of the inverse metric multiplying the derivative of the metric, and that translates into omega AB derivative of omega AB. So here I take the matrix product, so that's the summation over B, and then I take the trace, that's the extra summation over A. So that's the identity that we're looking for, except that I need the square root, so we can quickly work this out. The determinant, the derivative of the metric determinant under the square root, well, that's going to be 1/2 1 over the square root times the derivative of omega itself. And what do I get from this? I get 1/2 omega divided by square root of omega. We get the square root back, and then we get this over here. All right, so a very long story, just to say that we have what we need for the inside of the integral. So I'm going to write it like this first. Let's put the square root under here to keep them together. And then we're going to have omega AB d lambda omega AB. But then we know that the 1/2 together with that derivative here gives me the dAB quantity that we've been talking about. So this is really omega multiplying B. And we recognize this as the trace of the B tensor. And that's precisely the thing that we called theta, the rate of expansion, fractional rate of expansion. So let's rewrite this. We have that d lambda of square root of omega is theta times square root of omega. And with that, we can complete the calculation, go back to the integral, and see what we're getting. So if we take that extra step, we get that the rate of change of the area is, let's remember what we had before. So that was for the fixed domain D, landed derivative of square root of omega d2 theta. So now I'm going to plug in that new result, and I'm going to get 1 over, sorry, I'm going to get theta multiplying square root of omega times d2 theta. And what is this? Well, that's the integral of my cross section of theta times ds. And that gives us, I think, a very precise meaning. So let's put a nice box on it because it's a very important result. It tells us that the rate of change of the area is given by the surface integral of something, and that something is theta. And that theta, well, that's the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional area. So another way of expressing this, that's the mathematically precise way of doing it, but another way of re-expressing this is to say that theta is 1 over the surface element times the lambda derivative of that surface element. So that's just the, you know, the integrated version of this, which is a bit mathematically a bit more precise, but it sort of reconfirms and reinforces the interpretation that we gave to lambda all the while, and it really corresponds to how the surfaces grow or shrink in time as they move up the hypersurface. So that theta quantity here that we get directly from B is really telling us in a fractional sense how the area is changing over time as the cross-sectional surface, the cross-section moves up along the congruence. And, you know, you can well imagine why this is an important quantity, because, you know, when we do talk about black holes, we'll be talking about the fact that the event horizon can increase in area, but never decrease in area. And that's going to be something that we'll encounter. That's going to be very much part of that discussion. And we're going to be relying on the fact that that theta that lives here has to be a positive quantity. And if it's a positive quantity, well, that guarantees that the rate of change of the area is itself positive. And that's essentially the basis of the area theorem for a black hole. So that's just to show that there's some important ramifications around this. And that gives us the foundation to talk about these things. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, good. So let me mention one more thing, and then I'll talk about the last topic for this part of the lecture. One distinction with respect to what we were doing before when we were talking about congruences of null geodesics is that in the old discussion we were using an affine parametrization that was given to us pretty naturally when we started out from the geometric optics point of view. So we naturally ended up with K as being defined by the gradient of the phase of our electromagnetic field, and that gave us naturally an affine parametrization. And the theta quantity that we were talking about then was derived in terms of an affine parameter. So we were talking about the fractional rate of change of area with respect to an affine parametrization. Here we've given ourselves a little bit more freedom in the parametrization so that lambda doesn't have to be affine. And the consequence of this is that this theta, the more general version of that, is no longer going to be the divergence of the vector field. So I want to just illustrate, I just want to tell you something because it's going to, you know, probably come back at some point, that little point. I want to say that because lambda is not affine, theta is not equal to the divergence of k. That was true in the affine parameterization, but it's no longer true in this case. And in fact, we can calculate the new relationship between these two quantities by just calculating this divergence. And it's going to be very easy to do because we have a very nice coordinate system that allows us to do this calculation very, very simply. So let's do this calculation. I want to calculate that. And a pretty well-known identity here of vector calculus or tensor calculus in curved space-time is that we can re-express the divergence in terms of covariant derivative in this way here, where we put in appropriate factors of the metric determinant. But we know what this metric determinant is in the selected coordinates that we've introduced before. So that's going to be what it is here. And then we take the sum over alpha, but we know that in the selected coordinates, K only has a non-vanishing component along lambda. So the summation over alpha here involves only lambda because that's the only direction where K doesn't vanish, the component of K doesn't vanish. So that derivative here ends up being just a lambda derivative. Inside here, we still have the square root of the determinant. And then that's it. That's the calculation of the divergence. So we do the calculation. First, we have to differentiate with respect to chi. Sorry, we have to differentiate chi with respect to lambda. And then we're going to lose the two exponentials, and we're going to lose those vectors over here. So the first term in the expanded version of this is going to be lambda derivative of chi. And then chi is dealt with, so we're going to lose those two exponential factors again. And what remains is going to be 1 over lambda d lambda, sorry, 1 over square root of omega, then lambda derivative of omega. So expanding this out, we get two terms, this over here, this over there. And we recognize what those things are. That's our kappa, as it was originally defined. And that is our theta, as is now defined. So what do we get from all of this? Well, we get that theta can be calculated in terms of the divergence of the K vector minus kappa. So before we didn't have the minus kappa because kappa was zero in the old discussion where the parameter was an affine parameter, but here as a generalization of the result, we have that, we need to add this term here in order to convert the divergence of K into that meaningful quantity. All right, we're good with that?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so then I'll do one more thing. And here I'll be a lot more sketchy because it would be, very tedious to go through all of those calculations directly. In the notes, in the posted notes, I don't give you any more details than this, but I refer you to a paper where you can find those details. So if you're really curious about what's coming next, you can find those details in the paper that I mentioned in the notes. But I think you'll get the idea. So I don't think we need to go through all of those details. So remember what we did in the time-like and space-like case. We had the system of Gauss-Kodaty equations that allowed us to relate four-dimensional curvature to geometrical quantities on the hypersurface, and this involved the induced metric, the extrinsic curvature, and all the other geometrical quantities that we can get from the induced metric. So that was the system of Gauss-Kodaty equations, and we talked about applications of this in terms of the constraint equations for the initial value problem, junction conditions, and all of this. Well, the same idea can be applied to the null case. We can relate four-dimensional curvature quantities to geometrical quantities on the hypersurface. It's basically the same idea, but it's now looking different because, well, the geometry of a null surface is very different. But let me describe this and let me highlight a couple of things that will be important for us later. So the idea is that we want to relate the four-dimensional Riemann tensor to geometrical quantities on the null hypersurface. And the way to achieve this would be more or less the same as what we did in the space-like and time-like case. So in that case, we were using our Gaussian coordinates, and then, I didn't do the calculation, but in principle, it was just about calculating all the Christoffel symbols, calculating all the components of the Riemann tensor, and then boiling it down to the Einstein tensor, and then seeing what emerges in terms of that kind of relationship. Here we could do exactly the same thing. We would go back to the metric that we started with, that metric over here, and we could proceed in exactly the same way, calculate all the Christoffel symbols, all the components of the Riemann tensor, and boil it all down to Einstein tensor and things like that. And it would be very straightforward, kind of tedious, because now we have, more metric components to deal with, and it's a slightly more complicated metric, so there would be more work involved. But I think you can tell, more or less how it would go. It would be just a very straightforward long computation. And then we would end up with something that looked like this. I won't show you everything here, but for example, we would have a relationship between, let's say, this component of the Riemann tensor. I'll write it as mu nu lambda alpha, and this lambda is not the same lambda. It's just a Greek index that's going to be summed over. So now I'm talking about the KE projection of the Riemann tensor, and that's something that can be related to stuff that lives on the hypersurface. So it would be related to the lambda derivative of that omega quantity that we introduced before. Remember, that's the thing that was defined in the transport equation for E. So we had it here. So it comes back here under the lambda derivative. It would depend on the theta A derivative of the kappa quantity, and then it would involve BAB omega B. So basically, four-dimensional Riemann tensor evaluated on the hypersurface and projected like this is something that can be related in terms of those basic quantities that describe the geometry of the null hypersurface. So that would be one component like this, and then there would be a whole bunch of other components like this that could be expressed in a similar way. So the Riemann tensor can be expressed in this way, and then we can boil it down to the Ricci tensor, and eventually we could boil it down to the Einstein tensor, but I'll show you a couple of results that relate to the Ricci tensor. So let's look at this component of the Ricci tensor. So that's the four-dimensional Ricci tensor, projected along K. And I hope that this is something that you'll recognize from the discussion we had before. That particular component of the Ricci tensor is something that we've encountered before. And let's see what it looks like when we express it in terms of geometrical quantities that live on the hypersurface. It's going to be given by the lambda derivative of our expansion scalar plus kappa times our expansion scalar minus half expansion scalar squared minus the square of the shear tensor. And I hope that equation rings a bell. Maybe someone will tell me what it is.
Ray-Chaudhuri.
Precisely, it's Ray-Chaudhuri's equation. And we shouldn't be too surprised about this because, it's exactly the same sort of relationship we worked out before. It's just that now it's expressed slightly differently because we have more explicit, a more explicit basis on the hypersurface. But it's basically Ray Chow. Well, we did it right here. Ray Chow Dury's equation. All over again. So the only difference is that in our original version of Ray-Chaudhuri's equation, we didn't have the kappa term because we had derived this again in the affine parameterization version of this. Now it's a slightly, more general version of this, but the physical meaning of the equation is still the same, and that's still the equation that will give us a focusing theorem if, we do the right things in terms of imposing energy conditions and, restricting the sign of that projection of the Ricci tensor. So exactly the same story emerges there.
And I have a question.
Yes, please.
That non-affine parameter does not violate null energy condition or create any problem or violation for that.
No, it doesn't. So the energy condition is only something that relates to the Ricci tensor, and it's basically the sign of this quantity right here. So the rescaling that we did for the K vector doesn't change the sign of this. And then the presence of the kappa term doesn't really change the conclusion regarding the focusing theorem, but it can just be included in the calculation without really affecting anything. So it just carries over without without changing the nature of the theorem, as you
Okay.
would expect, right? Because changing the parameterization of the geodesics doesn't really mean anything beyond changing the curve to a different curve, just in terms of the parameterization. So it doesn't change the physics behind the curve, and it doesn't change the fact that if it's converging in one parameterization, it's going to be converging in another parameterization. So none of this changes.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you for asking the question. So that's an equation that we've seen before, and that's an equation we'll see again because that's going to be part of our black hole discussion with the kappa term present, because for the black hole discussion, it's going to be pretty important that we're dealing with the non-affine parameterization of our null geodesics. Okay, there's a second equation like this that looks similar and represents another component of the Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor, sorry. And let me write it down. Again, I won't derive it, but in principle, it's just a matter of working through all of those calculations of Christoffel symbols and components of the Riemann tensor given the metric that we've talked about. So it's nothing very difficult, just a little bit tedious. So let me write down the right-hand side for this. So that's the, another projection of the Ricci tensor. Now we're going to have the lambda derivative of the omega vector that we've seen before. And we still have the angular derivative or the theta a derivative of kappa. So, not too surprising that all comes from over here. But now we have a few other things. We have minus half the angular derivative of the expansion scalar. So we have that. And we have, that term is interesting, that's going to be the covariant derivative of the shear tensor with a covariant derivative that's defined to be compatible with the omega metric. I'll just define that in a second. And then we have the expansion scalar that multiplies the omega vector. So that's an equation that looks, similar to what we had before, involves slightly different ingredients, but in all cases, we're talking about the component of the Ricci tensor projected in a, specific way, being related to all of those quantities that live on the null surface. And then this notation here, dB is just covariant derivative defined with respect to the omega metric. Okay, so I just wanted to show you this and advertise those results because, well, that's something that we're going to rely on in the discussion on black holes, but that's something that's basically, something known. This one is not known, and I'm not providing a derivation here, but I'm going to still use it in later portions of the course. Again, in the context of discussing event horizons. So even though I'm not deriving it, I'm going to be using it. And it turns out to be a pretty important equation for establishing the zeroth law of black hole mechanics, something that we'll talk about in due course. Okay, so that for me wraps up the discussion on null hypersurfaces. And the important points that we brought up here had to do with While the idea that on an null surface, there's always associated with it coming for free the network of null generators. So every time we have a null surface, we have those. And then, you know, we can use those generators to set up a nice coordinate system on each null hypersurface. And that allows us to define in a very easy way volume elements, surface elements. And we've talked about all those geometrical quantities like the expansion, the shear, all of this thing, you know, comes back on us because given the null surface, we automatically have that congruence of null generators. So all the stuff that we've talked about resurfaces in this context, and it will resurface again in the context of black holes. And the last thing that's going to be important for us is those Gauss-Kodazsky type equations that give us back the Ray-Chowdhury equation, very important equation, as we know, and that extra one here that we're going to use as a foundation for something else later. And that's the end of the section on hypersurfaces. And now, finally, with all this, you know, background work that we did, we're ready to talk about black holes. So that's what I'll do next for the next half hour. But before we do that, any questions about what we've talked about so far this afternoon? Okay, take that as a no. So let's move on. So finally, the big payoff. So we certainly put down a lot of groundwork to be able to talk about, well, probably the coolest subject that we can think of in general relativity, namely black holes. And the reason why I needed all of this infrastructure is that I want to talk about black holes in a very general way, and you're going to see what I mean by that in you know, as we keep going, not today but later. Today we're going to do some simple things, and we'll come back to the fancy stuff a little bit later. And so we're moving into black holes. And that's obviously a very big subject. And, you know, there are lots of stuff that I could have told you about regarding black holes. And I had to focus on, you know, some things, some very small subset of all the things I could have discussed about black holes. And those are the things that, well, depending on your taste, might be the more fundamental ones, the more interesting ones. But certainly they're the ones that are the most geometrical ones. So I really wanted to bring those geometrical ideas to the discussion and see how directly relevant they are to black holes. So the stuff that we'll talk about, you know, for the last part of the course is going to be relating all of those geometrical ideas that we've introduced when we talked about congruences, talked about hypersurfaces, and really bring them as, you know, bring them together in a way that allows us to talk about black holes in the most geometrical and meaningful way. But before I go into all of this, as I said, I want to, you know, first start with basic stuff. And it turns out that you can understand black holes, you know, you can understand a lot about black holes by just drawing some pictures. So so for the next few minutes and maybe for the rest of the lecture, all I'll do is to draw some cartoons and talk about various things about black holes. And I claim that the cartoons are enough. We don't need to do calculations. We can just understand what's going on with the cartoons, and that should give us a pretty good idea of what's going on. And then, of course, we can learn how to back this up with more precise mathematics as we go along. All right. So let's do black holes in cartoons. All right, so what's the idea of a black hole? Well, the idea of a black hole is that you have a star that collapses under its own weight, and as the star collapses, gravity becomes stronger, and at some point, light is captured, and stuff inside the black hole can never reach out to the outside. So that's the basic idea of a black hole, and we can draw a picture that describes this. So I'm going to start with, so it's going to be a space-time diagram, and the first thing I'm going to draw here is R equals zero. So that's going to be, you know, the origin of the coordinate system. Sorry, I I went a little bit too far down here. So that's r equals 0, so that's the center. And in this diagram, time will be up. Well, mostly. And space will be sideways, mostly. And what I want to draw first is the surface of the collapsing star. So the star will start out at some finite radius r, and it's going to be, healthy for a while, but eventually it loses its ability to support itself. And now the star collapses, and eventually it collapses all the way down to the center, where all of its mass is contained in a zero volume that we call the singularity. So that happens here, and at that point, we've created a space-time singularity, something of which we can't say anything because, the laws of physics, including GR, break down there. So we have no idea what that is. And we might as well as, we might as well say that all the mass is concentrated in a point, but we have no idea what this might mean, precisely. All right, so that's the collapsing star. And what I want to show on that space-time diagram is the behavior of light rays. So, early in time, gravity was pretty weak. So light rays were hardly deflected at all by the gravitational field. So they just went out unaffected or almost unaffected by gravity. And here, so I'm describing an outgoing light ray that I imagine was initiated at the center. And star makes it out of the, the light makes it, the light ray makes it out of the star, and eventually it goes out and it reaches infinity, with, very little delay coming from the gravitational field because gravity is very weak at that stage. But a little bit later, gravity has become stronger, so now the light becomes more delayed by the gravitational field, and I'm describing this in the cartoon by that kind of suggestion that it takes more time for the light ray to get out. As revealed by that, steeper slope here. And that's absolutely what's going on. The stronger the gravity, the longer the light ray is going to be delayed, and the longer it will take for the news to reach an observer at infinity. If we wait really long, what we're going to find is that that light ray that tries to go out is in fact trapped by the singularity, and it's, never going to proceed to infinity. And then there's a sort of marginal situation in between where we have a light ray that is captured by the gravitational field to a point where, as it's about to emerge from the star, it's been caught into a stationary state where it's not moving in, it's not moving out, it's just sitting there, moving with the speed of light, but sitting there at the same radius forever. And that's a light ray that neither goes in, neither goes out. It doesn't reach infinity. It stays there hovering at r equals 2m. And that, of course, is the event horizon of the black hole. That's going to be the boundary between the inside that is forever trapped inside and the outside that can reach infinity after perhaps a long time, but it will get there. So that's the black hole region. That's the outside of the. That's the outside of the black hole, and the boundary between the two is this null ray that basically is caught by the gravitational field and remains at the same place, spatial position for all times. Okay, so let's flesh this out a little bit, and I'm going to start indicating the null directions here. So it's a two-dimensional plot. So, I could rotate this around the axis if I wanted to try to make it look three-dimensional, but I find that gets confusing quickly if I do that. So I'll just leave it as a two-dimensional diagram. And on that two-dimensional diagram, well, we have an outgoing null direction like this, and we have an incoming null direction like this. So basically, light rays that go in are affected by the gravitational field, but not nearly as much as the outgoing ones. So on the diagram, we're not going to bother describing this action on the incoming rays. I'm going to always make them go at 45 degrees like that. But the outgoing directions, you're going to see that the light cones, those outgoing directions are flipping over as we go from the outside to the inside. So over here, we have the same more or less ingoing direction. what we see that the outgoing direction has been tilted quite a bit. And over here, if we were to look at the light ray that happens to be here at that time, while the ingoing direction would be straight in like that, but the outgoing direction would also be going in. So here the labels are sort of failing us, but we're still going to use them. We have the ingoing null direction and the outgoing null direction both going in. And that, matches the behavior that we saw here. So basically what we see is that gravity is tilting the light rays forward like that. And then over here at the event horizon, we still have a sort of more or less unaffected ingoing direction, but the outgoing direction is sitting still in terms of spatial position. It points straight up. So at that point, the light rays have almost completely tilted over, but they're just in that marginal state, just on the horizon. And as soon as we move in, it's going to be tilted inward. And if we stay outside, it's going to be tilted outward still. So basically, progression toward the black hole is a progression where the light rays, the null cones, tilt over like this from being more or less like this outside to pointing in inside. And I think that kind of structure here, I think, really tells us a lot about what a black hole is. And all that, remains to be seen is, well, let's do a calculation that shows that this is really how light rays behave in the curved spacetime of a black hole. And that's just, technical details. I think the cartoon is really informative in the sense of, understanding what this surface is all about. But let me put those, these notions a bit more, in more precise terms. So I really want to distinguish what is inside and what is outside the black hole, and we're going to have to come up with, some vocabulary to do that. And we're going to look at those transverse spaces that are orthogonal to those two null directions. We're going to look at that for guidance to distinguish what happens here versus what happens inside. So let's look at those transverse spaces over here. So here we have, one that lives outside the black hole. So let's call that, transverse space. And we have another one over here. We have another one over here. And we have another one over here. So the distinction between those transverse spaces that live on the outside versus inside is that if we look at the two null normals to a given two-dimensional surface here the two null normals really point in different directions. Out, in, whereas here, while the two null normals point, well, we label them out and in, but they really point inward. And that's the major distinction between being inside a black hole or outside a black hole. We're going to characterize it as, the property that the two null normals of a two-dimensional surface like this, that I'm calling the transverse space, are going to be pointing in two distinct directions, really, I mean, two very different directions if we're outside versus, well, two not so different directions if we're inside. So that's a little bit wishy-washy. I'm going to describe it in more precise terms later. Just now. So I'm going to try to say this again, but in much more, in a much more precise way. So we're looking at each transverse space. And you can see what I'm writing. And again, as I said, we identify two null normal directions. And we want to say, in somewhat more precise terms, we want to introduce a clear distinction between the properties of that versus the properties of this. So what we're going to do, so let's call, I'm not going to do this notation. But I'm going to take each one of those null normal directions, and I'm going to calculate an expansion scalar for the outgoing direction, and I'm going to construct an expansion scalar for the ingoing direction. So we have two null vectors that we can define being normal to each one of those surfaces over here. And I'm going to calculate an expansion scalar for the out direction and an expansion scalar for the in direction. And then if we think along those terms, then I think it becomes more clear how to distinguish this from that, because here it's clear that the, you know, outgoing null rays are expanding out and therefore increasing in size. You know, the transverse space is increasing in size. So that defines a null direction where the expansion is positive. The null rays over here are going in, so they're going to be converging in, and the cross sections moving in are going to be getting smaller. So that's a situation where the ingoing direction comes with a negative rate of expansion, whereas the outgoing direction comes with a positive rate of expansion. That's true here, that's true here, but it stops becoming true here, and it's certainly not true here. Here we see that the null outgoing null direction, so labeled, is such that the expansion is also going to be negative along the out direction as it is along the in direction. The null rays emitted here converge toward the singularity so that their expansion, the rate of expansion, is going to be negative. The rays are being focused. And that's how we can, you know, distinguish the outgoing direction that's inside the black hole from the one that's outside the black hole. So what I want to say here is that the outgoing rate of expansion, that's going to be positive outside the black hole. It's going to be negative inside the black hole. Whereas this guy over here is always going to be negative no matter what, because the ingoing rays go in, whether they're inside or outside the black hole. So that tells us of a way where we can use the, you know, the null rays and the properties of the transverse space as a way of precisely distinguishing what is inside the black hole, what is outside the black hole. And there's yet more terminology that I want to introduce here. That's the notion of a trap surface. So a trap surface, what is that? A trap surface is, you know, a two-dimensional closed surface. So it doesn't have to be a sphere, but it's going to have the topology of a sphere. And it will have the property that its outgoing null geodesics, you know, normal to the surface, will be converging. So it's a 2D closed surface with a converging. And what I mean by that is theta negative null geodesics in the outgoing null direction, normal direction. So that tells us, if we go back to the cartoon, let me give you a time to write this out if you want. So a trap surface is one of those 2D, you know, closed transverse spaces, as we've been talking about them, such that if I look at the null geodesics that are emitted outward in the null, in the normal direction, those will have the property of having negative expansion. And that's not the case here. So that's not a trap surface. That's not a trap surface, but this is a trap surface. So that one over here and any surface inside the black hole, that is going to be a trap surface. Because both null directions, normal to the surface, have a negative expansion scalar. As we go from the outside to the inside, we meet this situation here where the outgoing direction is no longer expanding, not yet converging, it's stationary. So that defines a notion for us of a marginally trapped surface. It's not trapped, it's marginally trapped because instead of being negative, the outgoing expansion is actually zero. So that's a marginally trapped surface. So let me now define that. A marginally trapped surface well, it's a very similar thing. So it's going to be a 2D closed surface with stationary. And what I mean by that is zero outgoing expansion, but stationary in all geodesics in the outgoing normal direction. So those notions are very important, and they allow us to characterize, roughly speaking, but in fairly, in fairly precise terms, they allow us to distinguish what is something, what is the inside of the black hole versus what is the outside of the black hole. We can describe this in local geometrical terms, in terms of the transverse space, looking at the null normals and deciding whether the null directions are both are converging and expanding, or whether they're both converging, and that gives us the trans you know that gives us the notion of inside versus outside. And then the boundary of the trapped region is going to be where theta turns from being positive to being negative. So the yeah, and that's where the marginally trapped surfaces are. And that's so that's the boundary of the trapped region. The trapped region is the space, the part of the space-time that contains the trapped surfaces. And another name for this that you'll encounter in the literature is apparent horizon. So very important characterization. And something that maybe you'll have noticed by now hasn't referred at all to the notion of an event horizon. And that's going to be the next step to talk about what we might define to be an event horizon. And I want to introduce a very clear distinction between those notions that we've talked about so far, namely trapped surfaces, marginally trapped surfaces, boundary of trapped regions, versus event horizons. So there's a very important distinction that this cartoon doesn't convey, but we're going to see a situation where there would be a very important distinction to be made. So what's an event horizon? Well, an event horizon, also a very important characterization of a black hole space-time. An event horizon is not defined in terms of those local characteristics that we've been talking about. It's really defined as a causal boundary, and that's something that is defined globally in the space-time. So the event horizon is a causal boundary. It's a causal boundary of the black hole. And it's defined in such a way that events inside are causally disconnected from infinity. I'll say from observers at infinity. And another way to phrase this is that signals from inside the horizon, inside the event horizon, can never reach the outside. So, I don't think that definition will surprise anyone. And the consequence of that definition is that the event horizon is necessarily a null hypersurface. So on this diagram, and if, you know, if that's all we were to consider, then I think it would be pretty clear that the surface R equals 2M would be the event horizon. Because if we're looking at anything that might originate inside, well, that would be, you know, a trap surface, and any attempt for a light ray to go out will be, you know, made vain by the focusing aspect of gravity. So anything that would happen, you know, inside the black hole, no matter how close or to the singularity or how close to the event horizon, anything, any event that would attempt to make a signal to the outside world would not succeed, and the surface drawn here would be a causal boundary between the inside of the black hole and the outside of the black hole. But here's where it gets interesting. Suppose that something else happens in that space-time. So, you know, a star was collapsing to form the black hole in the first place, but suppose that, you know, a billion years later, some more stuff falls into the black hole. More mass goes in. That will change the structure of the space-time completely, and it will, you know, create for us a very clear distinction between the boundary of trap surfaces, the boundary of the trap region, versus the event horizon. So let me try to draw this, and that's going to be the end today for today's lecture. So here's my R equals zero line, as I had before. And just to indicate the separation in time, this is my collapsing star. And beyond that, we have R equals zero, the singularity. So that's my stellar collapse over here. And as a result of that collapse, well, we had the event horizon forming. And for a while, we thought that the event horizon was right here at R equals 2m. So that's a star of mass m, and that's R equals 2m. But now something else will happen. More mass will fall in. Maybe the black hole will acquire another black hole or something like that. So let's assume that more mass falls in. And that's going to be, you know, some amount of mass that I'll call delta M. Well, let's think of what happens to those light rays that, you know, thought for a while that they were forming the event horizon. That those light rays are going to be encountering more stuff, more matter. I'm going to assume that the energy conditions are satisfied. And as they encounter this additional stuff, they're going to be focused by this additional stuff. So those light rays that manage to be stationary for a while, in fact, get focused in and fall in toward the singularity. So we didn't have any trapped region outside here, but now we're getting more trapped regions because of the infalling matter. So that's interesting. Let's think of another light ray that was emitted before that one over here. And instead of being maintained stationary by the strong gravity, for a while was actually expanding. And for a while, this light ray thought that it was safely going all the way to infinity. But that light ray also, you know, is encountering more stuff. That matter here will be focusing, you know, those light rays according to the focusing theorem. And here I've picked just the light ray in such a way that it was expanding in the past, but gets focused to a point where after encountering that matter, it's being caught by the gravitational field and stays stationary. That's R equals 2m plus delta m. So now we have something interesting. So before we had trapped surfaces here, 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 here. They were all inside the black hole, and none of those surfaces here, I'll draw them in green, none of the two-dimensional surfaces out here were trapped. Because, you know, the outgoing null direction is going out, and it's not going to go out forever, but at that moment, it's going out. So those are trapped, those are not trapped. But, you know, if we wait for the matter to fall in, what used to be outside of the trap region now becomes inside the trap region. That two-dimensional surface here has an outgoing direction that goes in and therefore is now trapped. And in fact, all of those surfaces that are inside the new r equals 2m plus delta m surface, those are all trapped trapped surfaces. So here we have trapped surfaces, trapped surfaces, trapped surfaces. And here we had a region that was not trapped that is now becoming trapped as a result of the focusing action of this extra matter. So what's the boundary of the trapped region? Well, it used to be right here. But because of the additional matter, it expands out until it catches up with that null surface right here. So that's the boundary of the trapped region. So there's a clear distinction between, let me say a few more words. So, the first thing that we see here is that the boundary of the trap region goes from, you know, the old r equals 2m surface and now expands out to the new r equals m to plus 2 delta m surface. We have now trapped surfaces here. We have a trapped region here where before we didn't have one. And now we have a new, you know, candidate for an event horizon, because that's the one that's going to stay stationary and will prevent anything that's being emitted, including all of this stuff. So if I have an event over here, and we're trying to emit an outgoing light ray to reach infinity, well, we thought for a while that this would succeed, but now it doesn't succeed. That light ray that we're trying to emit here, that signal we're trying to send from the inside of the black hole to the outside of the black hole, is actually not succeeding. So that light ray, that signal, is in fact trapped within the black hole, whereas this one over here, well, unless something else happens in the future, that one goes all the way to infinity without a problem. So what I'm trying to say with all of this is that the event horizon in the actual space-time that has more stuff falling in is very different from where we thought it was. We thought it was over here, but that's not it. It's over here. We had to cap, you know, we had to basically catch the right light ray that was expanding for a while so that it becomes focused by the infalling matter in just the right amount so that at the end of this interaction, it becomes stationary now and for the rest of times. Everything inside of that null surface is inside the black hole, even though inside the black hole, we can have a region like this that doesn't contain trapped surfaces. So there needs to be a very strong distinction between the region of trapped surfaces, which is not, which will be inside the black hole, but the region inside the black hole can also contain a region of surfaces that are not trapped. And it's only after you know what's going to happen for all times in the future that you'll be able to really locate the event horizon. You have to make sure that at the end of the day, you're picking the right null surface that stays stationary for the entire future. That will define the event horizon at late times, and the continuation of that null surface at early times will be the event horizon for those times. I hope I made that clear. So the point is that the event horizon is a causal boundary and it's defined globally. And in the case of a black hole, you really have to wait until the entire history of the space-time is unfolded before you can rightly identify which light rays are generating the event horizon. If you just rely on trapped surfaces, there's a big chance you'll get it wrong because, you know, sometime later, more mass could fall in. And in fact, an event like this could happen again and again and again. And, you know, this best guess for where the event horizon is could also be wrong, because in order for that to be right, I would have to declare that no other matter will ever fall in between now and the infinite future. So it's only when I know that, namely when I know the entire future history of the space-time, that I know how to pick up the event horizon properly. So that's the distinction between the boundary of trapped regions, the apparent horizon versus the event horizon. The apparent horizon can be found at any moment in time purely in terms of the local behavior of light rays. Either it's trapped or it's not trapped, and that's the only thing you need to know. Whereas the behavior of the event horizon is far more subtle and requires knowledge about the entire history of the universe for all times before you can decide that this null surface was really the right one to identify as the event horizon. So, in future lectures, so coming back next week, we'll talk more about how to figure out where the trapped surfaces are. So we're going to do calculations based on calculating expansions for the outgoing null direction. We're going to see how that works. And but eventually, we're going to be very interested in what happens to an event horizon globally identified like this during either a stationary phase where nothing else will ever happen, or perhaps during an expanding phase like this, where things are interesting, the horizon grows in size as it anticipates all the stuff that will be falling in later. So that's that's a curious notion that arises with event horizons because it's defined globally in space-time, because it's not something that is identified until you know the entire future history. Well, if you try to understand the behavior of that surface, null surface, in a course of time, you would be saying things like this surface, the event horizon decided to expand early in time so that later in time, when it catches up with all the matter, it becomes stationary. So it's as if the event horizon knows that this will happen in the future. If the event horizon was a local construction, that would be a completely, a causal thing to say, but it's not that. It's not something that corresponds to local physics. It's really something that corresponds to global physics, and global means you have to identify the entire future history before you can say anything about the event horizon as a function of time. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here. That's basically black holes in cartoons, and I hope the points were made clearly that we have a local characterization in terms of trapped surfaces and a global characterization in terms of event horizons, and they each have their, usefulness. We'll talk about each in turn as we keep, exploring the nature of black holes. Okay, so that's it for me today. So any questions before we stop? Okay, take that as a no. So I think let's call it quits for today. So I'll see you next week in person this time, unless.